This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, welcome back to our second session today. My name's Anne Farris and I work here at the museum in the Centre for Historical Research. Now, our second session of the symposium looks particularly at memorials and sacred sites and responds to the question, how are certain places invested with spiritual significance or defined as places of memorialisation? Our speakers will be Dr. Peter Stanley and Associate Professor Claire Smith, and following their talks, as in the previous session, we'll have 20 minutes of question times. So firstly, I'll introduce you to Peter. He's the head of the Centre for Historical Research at the National Museum. He was appointed to this position in 2007 after 20 years at the Australian War Memorial as Principal Historian. He contributes to historical interpretation in print and broadcast media, including television series Revealing Gallipoli, Captain Cook Obsession and Discovery, and Monash. He has written over 22 books, including two published this year, To the Far Side of Tears, Remembering the St Nazaire Commandos, and Men of Mont St Quentin, Between Victory and Death. His talk today will draw on this research he gathered while writing these books, reflecting on memory, memorials and sacred spaces. Thank you, Peter.
Well, thank you, Anne, and thanks, Leanne, for the invitation to promote my recent book. I'm sorry, to speak at this conference. Good morning, everybody, or good afternoon, everybody. What I'd like to talk about is one tiny place in France. Great. A place called Mont St. Quentin. Those of you who are militarily, historically inclined will know that on the 1st of September 1918, Mont St. Quentin, which is a hill in France near the Somme, was captured by the 2nd Australian Division. This is regarded as one of the triumphs of Australian military history, although I won't be talking about it like that. When you do read the book, which I'll wave about in a minute, you'll see that I regard this as a very contentious battle, and I contest the received version that it was a triumph of Monash's planning. But I don't want to talk about that today. I want to talk about one or a few of the men who were killed on that day, a man called Frank Roberts, who was an orchardist from South Sassafras in the Dandenongs, now a little town called Callista. And Frank's father, Gary, who actually was one of the people behind the move to rename it from South Sassafras to Callista, but that's a detail. Gary was, as you would imagine, traumatised by his death, the death of his son, Frank, in that battle. And Gary's response to this terrible event in the family's life was to inquire into it, to document Frank's experience obsessively. He created great thick scrapbooks which documented every aspect of Frank's life and death. And he specially wanted to know the exact spot on which Frank was killed and then was buried. And he gathered evidence from many, many sources, including contacting each of the eight survivors of his son's 12-man platoon. And as they came back to Melbourne at the end of the war in 1919, he badgered them and persuaded them and blackmailed them into writing down an account of what had happened to Frank. So I want to look at a very specific site of memory, and it's one that, as you'll see, was the site of intense interest, intense yearning on the part of Gary to understand what had happened, certainly from 1918 until for the next decade, but less so then, but perhaps more so in the future because of this work. I'll talk about that in a sec. This is the book that one of the books that Anne referred to. It's called Men of Mont St. Quentin. It's on sale in the museum's bookshop, and it tells the story of that one platoon on that one afternoon of September 1918, and then traces the survivors of that event through the rest of their lives, through 20th century Australia. So it's really a study in Australian social history. It starts as military history, and it becomes social history. My interest in historical sites goes back a long way, but in this book, which I published last year, A Stout Pair of Boots, those are Manning Clark's boots at the top. They're the boots in which Manning Clark tramped over many historical sites in the course of writing his epic history. In that book, I talked about historically hot places, places with historical radiation. And, of course, scientifically, it's complete bunkum. These places are not... you can't run a Geiger counter over a place of historic interest. You don't get anything. They're historically hot because of the knowledge we bring to them, and that's one of the themes of this talk. And the other, and if that's the theme of the talk, the subject is the Robertses. Here, let me introduce you to the Robertses. Down the bottom there, Gary and Berta, the parents, and their three children, Gwen, Bert, and Frank. Frank was killed at Mont St. Quentin. This is them just before the war, and the war, of course, changed their lives. They lived part of the week in Melbourne, in Hawthorne, in this house, Umana, and the rest of the time they lived at South Sassafras. They had a weekender up in the Dandenongs, and that's where Frank Roberts lived all the time. Umana, the building, as you can see, it's still there today. It's not a site of memory, but it may now become one in the sense that the story of the Roberts family and what happened to them from the 13th of September 1918, the day on which the family learned of Frank's death, and they learned of it here. So perhaps this will become a site of memory because of what we know about the story. The theme of this is the knowledge we bring to these places. And this is another place where the story begins. This is the Tramways building in Bourke Street in Melbourne. Gary Roberts worked in this building, and he walked into work at about 10 o'clock on the 13th of September, got to his office, had a chat with his staff, and then noticed there was a telegram on the desk. And there's the telegram. You might be able to read it. I regret to inform you that London advises that your telegram of the 14th August addressed to Roberts as being undelivered, the addressee being having been killed in action. That's the very banal and cruel way that Gary Roberts learned of the death of his son, and that started an obsessive search for knowledge about this place and about that event. Well, how do we know about this? Well, because of Gary's obsessive documentation, beginning with you can see the telegram is stuck into the one of the scrapbooks, and here's his diary, where, as you can see, Friday the 13th of September, the most awful day in our lives. And that's where the book begins, and it's where this search begins. Gary had the desire to know more, and we can understand why. The subjects of the story, as you see, Frank and Ruby on their wedding day, and there's Ruby with her baby Nancy, who was born in November 1917, by which time Frank was off at the Western Front. So Frank, there's lots of sadnesses in this story, and one is that Frank never knew his daughter. These are the men, or rather, these are like the men that Frank served with on the 1st of September 1918. If I told you that this was his platoon, several people in the audience would say, hang about, that's not the right colour patch. And indeed it is not. These are men of the 24th Battalion. Frank was in the 21st Battalion, but it's exactly the same. It's the same group of men with the same range of weapons. They both got two Lewis guns. They're in the same trench. It's Elsa Trench, just below Mont St. Quentin, minutes before both units went over the top to attack Mont St. Quentin. These are some of the actual men that Frank served with: Les Baker, Norrie Norwood in the middle, and Godfrey Dobson. And each of these men has stories, which of course are told in much greater detail in the book. And I'm not going to tell you their stories now, except to say that every single man in the platoon can be traced through the extensive records, not least being Frank's diary and their repat records, their AIF personnel files. And indeed, the citations, you'll see Godfrey Dobson on the right there has a medal ribbon, and that's because he was awarded the military medal at Mont St. Quentin. So there's a citation for him. So you can see their individual stories, which I won't go into. Of the 12 men that went over the top with Frank in his platoon, four of them died as a result of the battle, three of them on the spot, one of them 6 weeks later of a terrible stomach wound, which eventually killed him. And four of them, his comrades, were wounded, but of the eight who came back to Melbourne, six of them completed accounts of the day. And these are the accounts that they wrote, or one of them. You can see that the type of documentation that you can get, there's about 10,000 words here that Gary Roberts managed to obtain, typed by the Tramways Trust's typists. And then, as you can see, Gary also edited, went back to them, clarified, resolved inconsistencies, and constructed an account of the experience of this small group in order, he hoped, to write a memorial volume to Frank, but he was so overwhelmed with detail that, in fact, he wasn't able to do that. But what he did do was to stick them in his record books, and most of the images I'm showing you come from the record books, and he also gave a copy to Charles Bean, the official historian, who didn't use them, but he did put them in his papers, and that's where I found them when I was searching for a way into this event, and so that the platoon's experience became the microcosm that I explored. All of this is directed towards Gary finding the exact spot. Well, here's a photograph of the exact spot at about 25 minutes before Frank was killed, taken by the official photographer, Hubert Wilkins, and that's the summit of Mount Mont-Saint-Quentin. It's forest on the top, it's wood completely or almost destroyed by the shell fire, not just on the 1st of September. This had been a site of battle for the previous 2 years. But that's the objective. That's the place that they attack towards. And that's more or less the same view today, so that the forest has grown back, the village church has been rebuilt, the trench has been filled in, but you can just about trace where it was because it's chalk soil and the chalk shows through the beet fields. So you can see where the excavations were. This is the view that Charles Bean saw. Charles Bean was the official historian, as I say. It just happens that he was standing on an adjacent ridge watching the battle. He arrived just too late to see Frank killed, but if you see that red cross on the left there, that's more or less the exact spot where Frank was killed. The Australians attacked across the screen, following the edge of that wood from right to left, and where that X was a quarry, which the Germans had turned into a strong point. Frank's platoon attacked that strong point, and in attacking it, he died. And I won't go into the circumstances of his death. We talk about memory, that there are about four different accounts by eyewitnesses of Frank's death. Two of them mention bullets, another mentions a grenade. All of them mention different times from when he was wounded to when he died. So it just bears upon the fragility of memory that Judy was telling us about. So that's the view of the Mont today. Some weeks later, the Australian war artist Sir Arthur Streeton turned up, and of course it was suggested that he paint the Mont, because it was a scene of a great triumph by Monash and Monash's men, and that's what he painted. And of course, if you look at it, it's quite different to the scene I've just showed you. It's from almost exactly the same spot. You see the road running up the centre. Streeton exaggerated the height of the Mont to magnify the achievement that the troops had done. It's in the National Gallery of Victoria. Here's a bit of irony. It's in the National Gallery of Victoria and has been since about 1924. And Arthur Streeton was a neighbour of the Robertses in South Sassafras. Sadly, it seems that although Gary was a friend of Tom Roberts, the painter, he didn't know that Arthur Streeton, another neighbour, had painted the exact spot that Frank had died. And given the degree of interest he took in it, it's just extraordinary that he never found out. There's some of the record books. There's about 20 of them. They're about a foot and a half thick, and they're absolutely chock-a-block with Roberts family memorabilia and documents, local history stuff, tramways history, Victorian local history. They're also full of this sort of page. There are dozens and dozens and dozens, I mean literally dozens, of photographs of Frank's grave taken by various visitors at various times, indeed of various graves, because Frank was exhumed and then buried in the war cemetery at Peron, just down the road. And there are pictures of all of these places in it. He was absolutely obsessed, including a plan of the battlefield drawn by one of Frank's comrades, Tom Wignall. I believe it was Tom Wignall, which shows the exact place. You see, you come back to this obsession with ground. Even a photograph taken of General Monash and his daughter Bertha, who visited the grave in May 1919. How on earth this happened? Monash, of course, the great commander of the Australian Corps, he only visited two soldiers' graves in France. One of them was Frank's. How this happened is another story. But the fact is that this went into the scrapbooks as well. There's the mourning brooch that Gary had commissioned to have made to remember Frank. It's a very sad story. The graves at Peron today, so the three men who were killed on the Mont are buried together in the war cemetery at Peron. There are also German graves, of course, down the road. This is not a site of memory in many ways because the German cemeteries are neglected. They're very bare. They're very sad places. It always seems to be cloudy when you go into a German cemetery, and I don't know why. But it seems that these places are not sites of memory, although there may be families who come and visit. They're not subject to the great tourist traffic that goes through Commonwealth War Grave cemeteries. Also on the top of Mont Saint-Quentin was built a memorial. There's some sappers hanging around on the site of it. Very soon after the battle, within days, it was determined that a memorial would be built on top of the mountain. And you can see why it was captured. It's a very commanding view. The sculpture that was erected on top of the Mont was done by a friend of the Robertses, Webb Gilbert. Charles Webb Gilbert was a friend of the family. He had sketched Frank in London just before he died, And he told Gary that the face he put onto the statue was Frank's. So Frank's face turns up on the memorial. But this, if you go to Mont St. Quentin today, and some of you may have, you won't see that because the Germans came back in 1940, saw that a statue of an Australian bayoneting a Prussian eagle was not only an insult to the Reich, but could also fund its foundries, and they melted it down, took it away. It's been replaced by this statue today, a more contemplative figure. But it remains a site of commemoration. You can see on the left there the poppy and the flag and the koala, which indicate that Australians still come back to this spot in order to remember in various ways. And that's the exact spot today. It's no longer a quarry, it's been filled in. And the point about this is that if you go back to this spot, and you can find it on maps, you can use the maps that you can find in the war diaries, in Charles Bean's papers, in Gary's scrapbook, in the official history, you can triangulate where this place is. You can go there and stand on it. But if you go there and stand on it, you won't find anything. You find a very pleasant bit of field next to a French wood. And my point is that it's only because you bring to it knowledge, it's only because you know the story, it's only because you've read those soldiers' accounts that you can make any sense of this place. So ask yourself what would have happened if Gary hadn't collected that material, if he'd simply withdrawn into himself and perhaps mourned Frank for the rest of his life. He died in 1933, but not written anything down. This place would be indistinguishable. Lots of people died at Mont St. Quentin, French, Germans, Australians, British, but we know a lot about it because of this man's consuming interest. So Frank and his platoon, number 9 platoon, become the subject of our research and reading, not because of the site, but because of the documentation. So in fact, I'd argue we work from the paper to the place and not the other way around. Now, that's all I wanted to say. My point is fairly straightforward. Of course, I want you to buy the book. I want you to read the book. But I very much look forward to your questions and comments later. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome Associate Professor Claire Smith as our second speaker. She's from Flinders University in South Australia, where she commenced teaching archaeology in 1998. Her primary research interests are in Australian archaeology, especially rock art. While she has conducted field research with Aboriginal communities in Australia, Asia, and North America, she mostly works with Aboriginal people from the Burunga and Wagula communities in the Northern Territory, and has completed fieldwork there annually since 1990. And she works with the Ngadjeri people from South Australia. She has a particular interest in bringing about sustainable, long-term changes in community attitudes to Aboriginal people through the school curriculum and through enhancing community appreciation of the unique accomplishments of Indigenous Australians. In addition to teaching, writing, and editing books, she is the president of the World Archaeological Congress. She has been part of a project to support archaeological education and training in economically disadvantaged countries. Her talk today will discuss social issues around a range of memorials and sacred sites in the Baruga-Woolooga region of the Northern Territory. Thank you, Claire.
Just get this right. For those of you who are attentive, you might notice that the title of my talk's changed slightly. So I started off calling it Sacred Sites and Memorials, but when I was preparing it yesterday, I wanted to move more into the present because I think there's some interesting things happening at the moment. So I've added in Sites of Memory. So I've just added in a little bit extra. Now, I'm not used to these PCs, but it seems to be working. Okay, I work in Burunga and Woogala in the Northern Territory. I work there with my husband, Gary Jackson, who's an anthropologist. And we've originally went there in 1976. We went to Katherine and we worked. I worked as a barmaid and he worked at the meatworks and we had all sorts of interesting normal lives. And long before I became an academic, And then in 1990, when I was looking for somewhere to do my doctoral research, my mate went through my local contacts there and went back and did research there. And we've been there every year since then, and people come and stay with us. We stay with them. We also work in South Australia with the Ngadjeri. I'd just like to say that what I know the Barunga Woogla region I know very well because I work there all the time. Some of the things that I say can be extrapolated a little bit, but some of them are really specific as well, so I just don't want to pretend to be an expert on all of Aboriginal Australia. I really should have called it, you know, Sites of Memory in Barunga Australia or Barunga region. Okay, so this is the general region where we are, and I've just got this to show you some of the linguistic diversity that's there. And you can see the scale on the map. Barunga's down here, it's in Jawan country, but it also has a lot of people, Malpon-speaking people, Rembanga, Mayeli, and others. The kind of linguistic diversity is the kind of linguistic diversity that you get in Europe, and the kind of social sophistication is the kind of social sophistication that you get in Europe as well. I work on Bagala clan lands of Jawan people, and this is just a little example of the country. These are the people I work with. This is our camp. So we've worked there for 20 years. And this is our camp. That's our little camp. And the caravan is usually used as an office, and we sleep in tents around it, and students come up and so on. But that's our side of memory there. So in terms of this, the social system, I just wanted you to be aware of the moiety system, which is Dua and Yuritja. And these are the sections, these subsections, and there's 16 subsections. So when you become part of the community, you're given skin. So my skin is Bungan, which is over here in the Yuritja side. My husband, I have to marry a man of the opposite moiety, Gamarung, and so on. There's all these. So at the first level of complexity, there's 196 relationships held in the oral history, in the minds of people. And once you go to second level of complexity, it's over 1,000. And all this information about who you can sit next to, how far, who you can talk to, who you can't talk to, who you can marry, that's all held in people's heads. And this just gives you a little bit of an idea of who you can marry and who you can't. Oh, that one's, and I moved it into Jawan there too. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit about sacred sites first. I'm going to try and take Peter's direction and talk less and leave more time for discussion. So if someone can warn me when I've got 7 minutes to go, and then I'll talk faster. Okay. Really, I think the points at the beginning here are probably things that most of you know. I think it's an informed audience, so you understand that the dreaming still exists today. You understand that the land is impregnated with meaning, that it's a living landscape, that it's a powerful landscape, that it can be a dangerous landscape, that if you go to the wrong place, you can get sick, and that's how people really seriously feel it, and I certainly believe it now, having been there. And that it's a subtle and sophisticated social system. Okay, this is Edith Falls, which is actually, it's not a sacred site in the sense that it's you can't go there, because obviously I can't show you sacred sites that you can't go to, because I can't go there. But it's full-neck lizard dreaming, sops bite, and there are areas around here that are restricted sites that people, only men, sometimes only women, sometimes one doer and one Yuritja person has to go to that place. It's so powerful that if only one person of one moiety goes, then they can get into trouble and have a problem. This is a Kakadu dreaming place just near, very close to Barunga, with a little sacred sites authority marker there. And this is just there. It's like it's the guna of the white cockatoo. It's the feces of the white cockatoo is the story, and there's a trail and so on. But this is all an ochre spot. This is a woman's site, and that I knew for about 10 years. I had this really only one little secret thing that ever got told to me, and I thought, oh, I'll just keep that to my little heart. I'll never tell anyone this. And then I was in a minivan with a whole lot of young boys in the back and girls, and I heard someone say this secret thing. And it's like, oh, how's this? And then I found out all the kids know this. This isn't so secret. I thought it was secret. It wasn't told to me this is secret, but I thought it was secret. This is a BP. It's a breast of a lady, and it's an old lady. There's a young woman's breast nearby, and this is physical evidence for people that this is these women went in this place. And the secret thing that I kept in my little heart for 10 years is that part of the proof that it's BP, a breast, is that there's a little spring at the top of it, and that means, you know, like when a woman gives milk. So this is a site which is not an initiation site for young men, but it is part of the initiation process. This is old Jimmy, who I work with very closely, and it's a mukmuk site. This is a rainbow serpent, and it's giving birth to these mukmuks, which are owls. As part of the young men becoming adult, they have to... In the old days, they would collect kangaroos, and they would have a ceremony here at a particular time, and that meant young men were then able to go out and hunt kangaroos to get for their wives. So were more suitable. This is a hand stencil at this place of a young man. So again, we went to this site for maybe 12 years, and I knew this as a young man's kind of initiation site, but not really but when they had that ceremony, when they had it, the area was closed off for the ceremony, but then it's open the rest of the time so people can go there. So it's quite open, you know, white people can go there for swimming and so on. And after a long, long time, Glenn told me the story. She was there one day, she was often there, but she said, "Yeah, but you know how it really works, don't you?" I said, "What, yeah, those young men go there, the men do their men's thing and the women sit at home and knit." And she said, "Yeah, but that mother it has to provide those bones." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Well, those kangaroo bones down here, that mother has to provide those bones." So the young man goes hunting, he collects the kangaroo, he gives the bones to his mum, and she looks after them, and when there's enough bones, you can have that ceremony. So the mother actually has a lot of power there, because she can find those bones, she can look after them carefully, she can lose those bones, she can say, that ceremony coming up, I don't know where I put all those kangaroo bones you gave me. I don't know where they are. So there's a lot of hidden power there for women there that wasn't there in the original story. And the point there is that information only came out after working there for more than a decade. So, and working there continuously. Like, I lived there for 1 year once, another time 6 months. People live with us for 8 months at a time sometimes. So there's many, many levels of stories that will come out after a lot longer. I just wanted to make the point that site was open and closed. It's not just that sacred-secular dichotomy, which I'm sure everyone here would be aware of. In terms of sites of memorials, this sign was up for I don't know how long, but long, long time, wasn't it? And when we first there, no entry, Aboriginal ceremony in progress, well, we thought, well, no entry. And then after about a year and a half, we thought, gee, it's gone a long time, that ceremony. Of course, it was a memorial site. It was a memorial to that. Okay, so I'm just going to talk a little bit about memorials, which I'm going to interpret in terms of dead people in this case. And this is a funeral of somebody who we know. And this was actually a little bit contested, because where he was buried was a highly contested thing, because people wanted him... One part of the family wanted him buried up in the hills old way, another part of the family wanted him buried Christian way. And the part that we're closest to of that family is the Christian side. And so we heard both sides, but the Christian side were very upset because he got buried up in the hills, at a place that women can't go to. These are lawcorns, which are burial poles where we are, and there's one for each individual, and their personal possessions go into that. So these are actually, and sometimes two people. One of these has two people, one at one end, one at the other. I think you've got some in the galleries that are done sort of tourist ways with lots of designs. And Aboriginal people, where I work, do them two ways. So plain way for themselves, for the community. But if you're making something for tourists, they've got to be short, not long like this. And I know that they do them long in other places. And plain, and this is to do with the moiety of the person and their skin and so on. Okay, Good. These are another kind of memorial, which is to individuals, which is, in this case, Willie Martin, and some people here possibly know Willie because he's a very strong and powerful man. And we have some of these kind of stones around the community. And again, this is a memorial to someone who passed away, and you put your hands with ochre and you go around that. And sometimes people, there's a little kind of ceremony that goes with that, and sometimes it goes around the car that held the dead people and those kind of things. And people who work in communities will be aware of all that. Okay, I just want to talk briefly about hands as individuals, memorials to individuals, really. And that's also crossing cultures a little bit I'm going to talk about. This is from a video that we made in 1992, so it was a long time ago now. And these old men were painting rock art. This is Paddy Fordham Wainwaringa. There's Paddy Fordham stuff here in the museum, because I know because you guys bought some when I was up there. This is Jack Chatham. And they were making these rock paintings, and I said, can we video? And Paddy wasn't actually even going to be involved, and then he saw the other men going off and he jumped on board and came that day. These are kids visiting again a little bit later, that hand stencil there. Peter doing some other paintings at that time. This is, I don't know, but I can maybe tell the story of how Peter, he hasn't really passed away, he walked away a couple of years ago. And that's Paddy. And that's his painting. And this beautiful art, eh? But nothing there today. It's in a... nothing, because it's all washed away. Because it was in an exposed place. And they knew that when they did it, although this is what Paddy says about hand stencils. They can be there for 1,000 years. No bush clothes or anything will remain. In a good cave, as in not in this place, but in another good cave, it'll be there forever. Your son can look, or your grandson. Reminds him of his grandfather or his old uncle. He belonged to this country. I live here and nobody can shift me out. So it's a sign of right to be there, right to stay. And we're talking about people who've come from other countries and are now living on Jawan country. So they're always, in a sense, always a visitor. They're certainly not the owners. They might be custodians, though. This is the thing to make children remember, not only Aboriginal children, but all children, wherever they live, to make children remember so children can say, we've got history. I thought that was lovely. Okay, that's old Kochop Peter, and with school kids, so we were actually excavating at this site and we did some school tours and all the kids came out and he talked about country. And it was really good because he was saying things like, oh, these Muninga, these white people here, you know, they're really weak, you know. You leave them alone in the country, they'll die. They've got no, you know, they've got no ability to survive, but we can survive. We can survive here. And so it's very empowering to be in country, teaching in country. And again, that's Peter going back another time, putting a hand stencil, hand print in this time on a separate visit. And I'm thinking that this has continued in different different ways. So these are kids at school and we do some talks at schools and do some games, skin games and things. And again, this is just in a house that was getting fixed up, but people had just put their hands there. So this is a continuation of that tradition, but in a slightly different place. This is... little hand, baby's hand, out at a site called Jurewun. Okay, sites of memory. I'm just going to go through these briefly because I really do want to leave time for our talk. These are the Maranboy mines. Started in the 1930s, very productive. Lots of people had worked there. First contact with white people for a lot of people. Peter teaching in country. This is it. Now that's the Maranboy mines. This is the water pump moved to the community. So it's a memorial to that time in the community. Names of streets and memorials to people. But then there's also things like this. So this is people just having a good time. And what's the physical evidence of that? Not a lot. Even just doing up houses. People go past those houses, they've done up those houses. Those are important and they're very good for how you feel about yourself. My point here is the graffiti, really. And this is Wendy, who I work with really closely. And people write their names on things, and it's a way of, you know, putting their identity in. And it's mostly done by kids, but it's something. And we actually took up the habit, and we all wrote on our chairs. But I forgot to put that in there. This is just way off in the bush, somebody's bike that they loved, and it's set up and it's very careful, or someone set it up, and it's also a memory of a good time. So rubbish can be a trigger for memory. Sites of memory in the wider world. People know that we're here, they know that we're here. I'm here talking today, and as you're looking at them, they're kind of looking out at you too. So I go back and we talk at things, and this is my own home, which is like a little memorial, a site of memory anyway, because of all the paintings by old people. And this is an exhibition that we're hoping to get, that we're talking to the Smithsonian about getting up from the community. And this is an exhibition that has already happened in Valencia in Spain. So the memories or the stories go out. Living heritage, obviously, this is just to give you a sense of people's lives, kids' lives. This is the school, all those things that make you proud. Barunga Sports and Cultural Festival, such a big event for us every year, and that's there as a permanent part of community identity. Briefly, I'm nearly finished, I'm going to talk about the Northern Territory Emergency Response. And that happened 2 years ago, and you'll know that James Iaño came this, you know, has been here for 12 days, and he's declared that it was racist, which I think we all knew. But, of course, it's a problem. Everyone's worried about what to do in communities, black and white, everybody. And so I don't think, you know, people are trying, but maybe there's some problems. But the thing that made me sad was this was maybe 2 months after the intervention came, and people had seen things happening in Alice Springs and other places. And the response of the community, and this wasn't done by the managers, this idea was community people's ideas, was let's put up a flag. And they put up two flags. They put up Aboriginal flag, saying we're proud to be Aboriginal, and they put up that Australian flag saying please don't forget that we're Australian. So when we went to the community, I nearly cried when I saw that. Rubbish story. This is how the interventions are coming out on the ground stylistically. You can see the old rubbish bin, great for colours, you know, Aboriginal colours. Not really very practical. Dogs get into it, pull rubbish out, everything. This is practical, but it's kind of telling a different story. And I'm not really criticising it because I think there's lots of parts of the... I have been very critical of the intervention, particularly in the early days. A lot of it is working now, so I'm not as critical as I was because I can see it's working. Some of it still needs fixing in bits, but a lot of it's working on the ground, much more than I ever expected. And just things that, just because I thought you might want to see how kids live. Okay, and these are things that really not much physical evidence of. You know, you go fishing, you've got a fish, but these are really important sites of memory. There may not be much physical evidence, but that going fishing, catching a bird, riding, doing tracks, animal tracks in the sand at Beswick Falls. Those kids have lit all those fires because that's part of that fire stick farming that people do, and kids just do it, and they're controlled. They're controlled fires. These are soap tree, just close by at Whitestones, and you just get those leaves, and you rub them up, and you can shampoo your hair and wash yourself. So all the kids just doing that naturally with the... So all this cultural stuff that's part of day-to-day life. Footy, you know. You know, going into town, into Catherine, and... the Arnhem Crows won. But also coming to other places. So this is when people came and visited us in South Australia, and we all went into town, we went into Marion and had photos taken with Santa. So it's all part of people's lives. This is our camp. And you can just see all the people just sort of, you know, just kind of chaotic in a way, but I love it. And finally, I think somebody earlier finished on a photograph of the kids, I think maybe Anwar. Someone, anyway, and really it's all about the kids in the end, isn't it? Thank you.
Well, thank you both for those interesting and thoughtful presentations. Now I'd like to open the floor up for questions, and I expect there'll be quite a few. So we've got till 1 o'clock, so I've got a fairly solid 20 minutes.
Thanks. I'm Leanne Dempsey from the National Museum, and I have a question for Peter about the beautiful house that you showed Umana I was wondering about the family who currently live in the house, and have you had contact with them? Are they aware of the story that took place? And I'm interested in basically knowing how that's worked into their lives and their memories.
I am now. Here's an ethical problem. Do you knock on the door? I drove around Melbourne for a day in February last year, taking photographs of all the houses that all of the men in the story had lived in, because the records tell you where they, you know, even the repat records will tell you where they were living in the 1930s and so on. So I photographed all the houses, and I didn't knock on a single door. I didn't knock on a door and say, hello, I'm from the National Museum writing a book about the people that used to live in your house, because I thought, yeah, I thought that was too complicated. So I took a photograph of Humana, and it was only when the book was in press that I thought to myself, I'm using a photograph of someone's house, so I'd better contact them. So I did. Hastings Street has been renumbered, so the letter went to a different house. But they said, this isn't our house, it's the house two doors down. Anyway, they are aware now, and well, I haven't met them, but they're coming to the launch, which will be held in Melbourne next week. So and indeed the neighbours are now interested too, because they're more interested than the people who live in it, it seems. But the thing is that this story, which was completely unknown, the house is almost the same now as it was then. So the story which was unknown is now going to be known to them. The thing is, it's not their family. They're not related to these people. So I think there's a much weaker historical connection. It'll now become a... I mean, they'll give them a copy of the book. It'll be on the coffee table for a while. At dinner, when people visit, they'll say, oh, and this house has got a bit of a story. And they'll tell the story, and it will become a part of its heritage. But it isn't anything near as... Like the Gilba Georgalis, who is the granddaughter of Frank and Ruby. She's the one who's got the mourning brooch, and she's the one who's got the last of the scrapbooks. And her children will come along to the launch, and so that it's a much stronger connection for them. So that there's different degrees of warmth, if you like, or the radiation is much a weaker crackle for some people than for others.
Peter, this is a question for you again. I was interested in the difference between the German graveyard and the one where Frank was buried, and your experience of them, and how those sites of memory are used by contemporary people, and how that might feed into constructions of identity. And you didn't kind of elaborate on your idea about the popular history that's known about the Battle of the Mont, but that you're somehow kind of contesting that history in your book. So how the popular history is held, or, you know, ideas of that history, and how that feeds into identity and our experience of memories of sight and all that sort of complexity, and then how the Germans aren't doing that and why, and how that's kind of, you know, I don't know. I'm sure you've thought about all that.
There's kind of two questions there, isn't there? Which is cheating a bit, but let's deal with them one by one. We take for granted that war cemeteries are beautiful places where people are commemorated individually, and that when you go there, you'll see flowers and inscriptions and wreaths and comments in the visitor's book. And all of us who've been to the Western Front or any war cemetery kind of regard that as normal. And we regard it as completely normal that the state, both the Australian government and the Commonwealth, you know, the British Commonwealth, supports and maintains and opens those cemeteries. If you're German, the experience is completely different. If you're German, those cemeteries are basically... And British cemeteries, British and Australian cemeteries, the land was given freely by the French nation in perpetuity. If you're German, the experience is completely different in that you had to buy the land off the French, who gave it grudgingly. There isn't a Commonwealth... There isn't a German government organisation that maintains the ceremonies. There isn't all that infrastructure. And, of course, in Germany, there isn't the great sentimental attachment to the dead of the Kaiser's Germany, still less Hitler's Germany, that induces lots and lots of people to go overseas and look at these ceremonies. So that the two experiences are diametrically opposite. I mean, ironically, they both represent memories of the victims of war, in that the Germans who died at Mont St. Quentin weren't really fighting for the Kaiser and, you know, can't be condemned for doing that. They're just victims as much as Frank Roberts and his friends are. So that the national histories dictate the contemporary experience of the cemetery. But for Australians, that's even more different, because for Australians, as we'd all know, have enormous emotional investment in the Great War. It's connected to our national mystique. Even though the Western Front's less significant than Gallipoli, say, it's still becoming more important, and it's still very important to us because it's where the majority of Australians died. So Australians go to the Western Front with again, they bring with them this cultural baggage of understanding its importance before they get there. They may be shocked and saddened and surprised by their reactions to the magnitude of it, but they all know it's important when they get there. So, and one of the things that they bring with them is an idea that many of them bring with them, some people here perhaps, is that Monts and Quentin's a great triumph of Australian arms. Well, when you look into the battle, and I have to say my book began as a study of the battle, and I got disillusioned with battle history, which is one of the reasons why I'm here, but I got disillusioned with looking at it as a military event, and I wanted to understand it as a human event, and the route into the human event is the experience of this well-documented group. And when you start to look into it, in order to understand the context of their experience, you need to understand the big battle. And what I decided was that actually it was a chaotic battle that happened. I mean, I won't go into the detail because we don't want to know the tactics of it. But basically, it was a chaotic success rather than a well-planned triumph. You know, it wasn't planned that way. And Monash didn't win it. Monash wasn't even there during most of the battle. So it happened in ways that Australians might be surprised to find out, because their national memory, our communal memory, is that Monts and Quentin is one of the great triumphs of the AIF. So that when you start to unpick this memory, as we have here, we see that it's different for different countries. Our experience is different to the Germans. And it's different for us because the more we know, the more we understand that it doesn't fit into this triumphal mould which Australians naturally fall into, and which people like Les Carlyon and Roland Perry and a bunch of other popular writers would tell us that it fits into. So it's really as a result of that dissection that we can get that nuance. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Another question?
Could I follow that up with a question to Peter? Gallipoli was a monumental disaster. Why is it that we are so attached to it?
Barbara, I think there's a reasonably simple answer to that, although maybe there isn't. Four times more Australians died on the Western Front over four times the period than on Gallipoli. But Gallipoli was harnessed and remains harnessed to this idea of Australian nationhood. And it's been harnessed from before Gallipoli, that when they landed on Gallipoli, there was an expectation that those soldiers would in some way stamp their mark upon history. So it was a bit like Judy's memories that can be altered. It was a very malleable memory. So for nine decades since, Gallipoli's had that inescapable connection with the great project of Australia in the 20th century, the establishment and the identification with and the celebration of an Australian nation. So, of course, Gallipoli's attained that sort of priority. And it's for all sorts of reasons. I mean, I don't want to detain you by talking about the sort of epic trajectory of Gallipoli, that it's a neat story. It's a neat story of hope and struggle and noble failure, which is a lot more palatable or comprehensible than the Western Front, which is one damn battle after another, which nobody can tell the difference between, and which results in a victory that actually looks a lot like a defeat because of so many people dying. So Gallipoli's got all those sorts of epic qualities that the Western Front messes up by so many people dying in such a short time, in such a small space. So I think the question really ought to be, how come Australians haven't investigated and understood the Western Front more than they have Gallipoli? But I think that obsession with nationality and and nationalism that we've got is partly the answer, I think.
My question's for Claire. I just wanted to, if you could explain what you meant by that he hadn't passed away, that he'd walked away.
Yep.
And you were talking about the artist?
Yep. In April of the year before last,
I think. Old Kolchak just picked up his pillow. Someone had cooked him dinner, but he didn't take that dinner. It was nearly ready. He picked up his pillow. He didn't say goodbye to anybody. He just took a little walk. But he was never found. So we were down in south, and the police called us because people said to let us know. And my husband Jacko went up, and you looked for about 2 weeks, didn't you, with the police, and they had quad bikes and all sorts of things. And Jacko was looking like for a week after the police had given up. And they didn't ever find him. And it's the same for people, some of you know David Blanasi, his painting, a painting man. He did the same thing. So those old men kind of had this thing of, they decide they're finished and they go and hide somewhere until they die. I think they sing themselves to death or do something that they do. I don't know what they actually do because obviously that's their secret business. But he just walked away. And I'll tell you what, we're still cranky. He wasn't, you know, didn't have too much eyesight, but he wasn't sick. There was nothing wrong with him. And then, of course, afterwards, our first reaction was he wouldn't do that. And then afterwards, we all put it together. And the last time he was in Adelaide, he'd brought his son and he said, I'm not coming back. Next time you've got to take Cedric. And so we're sort of, you put those things together in retrospect, but at the time you think, oh, you know, he's just being grumpy, you know. We walk around sometimes and call out, come on, Kotchuk, I got rid of all them kids. My cat's got no kids now. You can come visit now. But nothing. Kookaburra one night, that's all.
Thank you, Claire, for that insight. Al Bridges from the Australian War Memorial. My question is really from my own ignorance. I believe that the Aboriginal stories have been handed down over a long time, the interpretation of their paintings as well. I guess a bit of a devil's advocate here. I'm a little bit concerned that now we're actually recording those, will we be stopping the further development of those stories? Why should we record them now and stop that further development?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a really good question, and it's hard because I can see the reasons for not. So things are interpreted. So say one young man, he had an accident and he killed a young girl in a car, and this was up in Weemol. And then old Peter, there was a lot of, and there could have been a lot of trouble between the families over this. This could have been something that really caused murder. And old Peter said, no, or old Jimmy. They said, no, it's okay. The devil took his hand and made that wheel go like that. And it wasn't his fault. And so the authority on high said, that's not that young man's fault. And that meant that people could sort of mourn the girl without having to do something to the young man. And that interpretation that old people do, and we do it in our culture too. We look for our elders to tell us, you know, how to interpret or what if we're doing the right thing and so on. And I'm thinking of John Mulvaney here as, you know, our elder. And so as soon as you capture that, of course, then you've got, and those things, different people have different views. So you capture it and that becomes canonical, and that's a real problem, I agree. I just don't know the answer to that.
Thank you, Claire and Peter. The question, and either of you may like to take it, in the case of the Western Front, there are grand, solid memorials, monuments. In the case of Aboriginal culture, just a strong memory, but nothing to particularly designate it. How do you suggest that we engender respect for those sites when there's nothing physical to actually see?
Can I have a go?
Yeah, but absolutely. Yeah, I'm still thinking.
My thought is that we should be teaching the achievements of Aboriginal people in the National History Curriculum. And we did do the World Archaeological Congress and Australian Archaeological Association did a 200-page submission to Julie Bishop on this, who I don't think she read it, and then we resubmitted it to Julia Gillard. But I think teaching people, even that little diagram of the skin, teaching our kids about, like, the first maritime colonisation in the world was the colonisation of Australia. You know, this is a big achievement. What do you think comes with the ability to build boats and colonise a continent? Probably certainly complex thinking, certainly symbolic thinking, possibly language. We've got some of the earliest examples of cremation, some of the earliest examples of rock art. So we've got some real human evolution first here in Australia, but we don't teach them to our kids. They should be taught. If we're America, how would you, if you're America, you'd be flogging it off to everyone. You'd be flogging it off to your tourists, to your kids, and you'd be proud of it. But somehow we're ashamed of our Aboriginal heritage, or in some way we're not willing to... I don't know. I really don't know why we don't do that. But anyway, that's something that we're trying to do something about, and let me know in 20 years if we're successful.
Thanks. Can I just see clarification from Faye that you were asking about how do you engender respect for sites, and you were talking not just about Aboriginal sites but about Western Front sites? Yeah.
Because that little site.
Yeah, so sites like Frank's that aren't marked. Well, I think we have... History doesn't exist independently of our making meaning. I mean, the big sites exist because war history has always been connected to the... You know, it's been sponsored by the state, and the Australian government continues to direct our gaze towards particular things to remember. But I think that diversity is really important, and that people ought to make their own minds up about what's important to them. And that's why it's important to continue to research and to discover things and invent new meaning or find new meanings, decide that something new things are important. But I don't think we should develop a sort of monument complex about this and go around building more memorials. There's been enough memorials built, which is why I was interested to find out whether the man who walked off, does he have a grave, or he can't have a grave, but does he have a memorial of some sort? So, or does he only exist in the stories told about him? So, because that's the thing. I think that there's a connection between the two, that we ought to tell stories about them, and that's where the true memorial is. But what's his?
He's got some he was very traditional and not Christian at all, but his wife's family are Christian, so there was some Christian story for a while about maybe having a ceremony, but then it just sort of died down, so really nothing.
But
nothing at the moment.
But he essentially will live in memory for as long as the memory survives.
Yeah, and I think that they will memorialise him in some way, but they haven't got to thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And there's certainly the graves. We've got a big difference in graves in the last 10 or 15 years. We didn't have gravestones, and now we do. Mm-hmm. And you can see the important families competing. Mm-hmm. And somebody who... Old Phyllis, who passed away two years ago, her granddaughter just said she's going to have a big marble grave and her photo's on it. Now, Phyllis wanted every photo of her burnt when she died, and we had to put a heap in the grave with her, but now her photo's going to be on that. But we all do what we do for dead people. Like, people, when you're dead, you get the ceremony your family want for you, not your own, I can tell you.
would his story actually end up then... in ceremony and on the bark paintings and all of the other forms, and not just oral?
Yeah.
I mean, Paddy, I would know Paddy Wayne, but I'm afforded back, right, who was there. And he, of all, that community of all communities, knows about how to talk about Captain Cook and World War II and how that began and the missions by incorporating things that are considered not ceremonial, which is debatable, into... traditional formats and styles, but content varies according to life evolution.
Yeah, that's a good question, Margot. Mm. Two things. One brief one is that he was talking once about those sisters who were walking through that country, and he said, and they saw those white men up at Minor Rear Station and they had guns, and so the sisters decided to go another way. Mm. So they do incorporate contemporary events. His son's is Cedric Manaburu. And he lives out at Gorge Camp, and he's a fantastic, fantastic artist, just beautiful art. But Cedric doesn't do... Well, he hasn't done that kind of story yet. It'd be interesting to see if it comes out. It might.
Which wasn't actually my question. But
oh, sorry. Oh, no, you were saying about in ceremony. Yeah. I don't know, because I'm never part of ceremony, so
But there's public ceremony as well as...
Yeah, the men go off and do stuff and then up on the hill and the women, we sort of play cards and stuff. Yeah. And then after they've done all their important business, we make them some tucker. And there is stuff down, but I think not in the kind of stuff that I've seen. So
actually, what I was going to just propose to... there was a question about by recording stories, are you actually stopping a tradition of the evolution of stories? So that was the story up there. Writing it down, for example, or putting it in technology that's not traditional. Well, you know, my experience in... there's two parts to this thing. My experience in traditional so-called Aboriginal communities is there's an incessant plea to do this, right? To do it because the younger generation, many of these communities, the next generation at least, are not interested in doing stuff. They want to hip-hop or whatever, all those other, and you know, watch challenger videos and so on. Like a lot of, so there's a real concern that they must be written, recorded for posterity in the event, so to be reclaimable, right? And there's the other point was, and it's really, you would know, it's really pervasive, it's everywhere. But then, of course, there's the where I come from, which is the Southern Aboriginal, which is 70% of the population or more of us who have to do those sorts of storytelling in means that are not considered traditional. And that's a significant proportion of the Aboriginal population in this country. So that might just throw a little extra light on that question.
I can certainly confirm that people want stories recorded more than anything else. And I suppose maybe what happens with those stories, when people want them back, they might not want them back for a while. Yeah. I mean, you give them back to the community, but they may not use them. You know, it might just stay in an archive in the library or something.
I'm sorry to take time, but I just recalled your idea of the flag saying we want to be Australian. Now, that's another big thing. These stories are Aboriginal history, and other Australians, non-Indigenous Australians, have history written, recorded and put in places like this, and they too want to be Australians have their in that way and have their history recorded in a way and put in places like this. That's another very strong impetus.
Thank you. I think that we'll wrap that up now. It's 1 o'clock. Thank you very much to Peter and to Claire for their insights. And I'd like you to be back at 2, please, so that we can start the next session.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.